If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Big Ben Strong is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
Good afternoon. It is 900 CHML. I'm Scott Thompson, Hamilton Today. Welcome to the fun. 980 CFPL in London. 980 CFPL in London. 900 CHML in Hamilton. Great to have you along. Feel free to jump into the fun. 905-645-3221. You can talk. You can text. You can leave us your last word. You can send us a note. Scott Thompson, 900CHML.com. Would love to hear from you. Hammerhead Trivia, giving you a chance to win your way to hear the music of Queen. Well, not the band, but them tribute performing their hits at the First Ontario Concert Center. That's all coming up after the 5 o'clock news, Hammerhead Trivia. Big Ben on the board and playing the share. And the reason being, it was on this day in 1999, using the pitch correction software Auto-Tune, which is actually the bigger story here than the hit. To distort her vocals, Cher goes number one in North America with Believe, and I think that's like four decades in a row, opening the floodgates for many more auto-tuned hits. It went on the market in 97 and quickly became an invaluable tool for producers correct vocal pitch in real time. But then when it's set to the extreme setting, it creates a distortion effect, which we hear on that song. There you go. Now you know the rest of the story. And any concert that you go to, especially the big ones, every single artist, I guarantee you, is using Auto-Tune. And that's why they sound so great. All right. As I said, feel free to jump into the fun. Love to hear from you. All right. We got some great news stories coming up. And I'm going to tell you all about that. But I heard a story last night and I'm thinking, I think I want to talk about this. I think I want to open with this. And you tell me what you think. Send me a note, Scott Thompson, 900CHML.com. You can, phone Ben, 905-645-3221. He'll record you, whatever. So, and I want to be very vague here. I don't want to tell you who, where, what, give any names, because it probably happens everywhere. And maybe you've got your own story. So I've got some friends. We'll leave it at that. And these friends go to, I'll say, a Hamilton area restaurant. Leave it at that. And they're going there for lunch. So they're in the restaurant, they're having a nice lunch and everything's great, dandy and stuff. And as you do in a restaurant, you're kind of looking around the ambience and what's going on and this sort of thing. And they notice a waiter, food staff, I don't want to see waiter, waitress, food server is behind the bar and they're, you know, getting drink orders or whatever. And the friends are all chatting. And then all of a sudden, one friend notices that the server takes a sip of a sip from a glass of wine. So then kind of the joke is that, you know, that the person up there that's serving, you know, some people have water, some people have Coke. This person's got a glass of wine going and who cares, right? Blah, 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 blah. And so they all kind of have a chuckle about it. And that's sort of what happens. And then all of a sudden that glass gets picked up and put on a tray and gets served to a customer. So. Server not so much enjoying a beverage behind the bar while working, but enjoying the customer's beverage with a little sip before it gets taken to the table. And the friends are all, did you just see that? Like, did you, you know? And so that's the story. And of course, my reaction was, well, did you say anything? And no. Well, why not? Why wouldn't you say something? Well, because we don't want our food compromised or create a fuss or do whatever, get anybody in trouble. So, I thought because my first reaction would be, and maybe I'd wait till I go off. Till I left the restaurant and paid my bill and such. And I might say, hey, but should you say nothing? Because obviously you're going to get this person in trouble. But then, of course, the stories start floating around about, well, you know, I heard people who work in kitchens and they've done this to the food and that and the other and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you know, the already struggling hospitality industry doesn't need this right now. But anyway, so, you know, I'd thought I'd throw it out there and see if I get any thought on it. And I guess my question is, would you bring it to the restaurant's attention if you saw this going on? I don't think I would be as inclined if the person was just simply going to drink behind the bar. You know, I'm not sure that's right, but, well, it's not. You're drinking on the job. But then to serve that drink to a patron, to a customer, that's obviously where it crosses the line. Or maybe you've got your own experience. Maybe you've been in a restaurant, you've seen this happen. Oh, someone drops some cutlery, picks it back up, puts it in the plate, serves it to the customer, whatever. I don't know. But, you know, I love going to restaurants. I love eating out. It's probably one of my favorite things, more than watching movies. So, you know, it's kind of, I'm surprised. But, you know, I've never really worked in the hospitality industry. I was a DJ, played at weddings and stuff, but I never was a server, never was a bartender, none of that stuff. So, and obviously it's a hard gig. It's a tough gig. But, you know, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on someone who takes a sip and then serves it to the customer? Do you tell? Do you bring it to anybody's attention? Ben, do you have an opinion? Oh, so you're not, Ben's not talking to me right now. I'm surprised. So, again, I'm going to throw it out there. Send me a note or give us a quick call if you've experienced something similar to this, witnessed something similar to this, maybe been in the hospitality industry or such. But I thought, you know, I think I would have said something. All right, what are we looking at? Lots going on. We talked about this yesterday. Doug Ford said he'll never, ever sell the LCBO today. This was, and I talked about this yesterday, misleading information coming out from Union that stopped the sale of the LCBO, the sell-off of the LCBO. And I started looking, it's like, looking this up. Did I miss something? Did I not see something? And no, they look at selling off the CBO or the LCBO if they're distributing alcohol in other venues, such as grocery stores. So we're going to talk about that. Lots of pressure on the Prime Minister to give a pause for the carbon tax, including 8 premiers and one of his own. We're going to talk about that. The U.S. banning TikTok if they don't get rid of the Chinese Communist Party ownership of it. We'll talk about that all on the way. We remember post-COVID-19 global pandemic, lots of chatter around our Winnipeg lab and the secret projects that they're working on, especially in and around viruses, vaccines, and such. And two Chinese scientists that were let go, husband and wife, due to allegations of sharing information with China on what they were doing. And a committee was called, what have you, and we're really not finding out any information. And I thought of this with the article last week by Andrew Coyne in the Globe and Mail. Will anyone ever be held to account for China's infiltration of Winnipeg microbiology lab? Don't make me laugh. And, you know, it's been an ongoing thing, and we really are not getting any more answers. Where are we with this? Let's bring in Dr. Robert Hewish, Associate Professor with the Department of International Development Studies, Dalhousie University, and is with us now. Robert, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, I am. Thanks, and great to talk to you as always.
Robert, are you surprised we haven't heard more information about this? Are you surprised that it's been as quiet as it has been?
Yeah, strangely enough, considering that the documents that we do have available, the ones from CSIS that have come out in some of the committee reports, really show that the two scientists in question were flagged by CSIS in 2020 as being a likely threat to Canadian intelligence security. And if not, at the very, very least, being what they call a pathway of convenience, a door of convenience to enabling China's government to benefit from the knowledge and technology that we were producing here in Canada, notably at the lab in Winnipeg. So the fact that all of this exists and that there's really no one who's been kind of put to the stocks, shall we say, in Ottawa for letting this go forward is a bit surprising. And I think that we're seeing that happen now as the inquiries about Chinese interference are rolling out, and that it's likely just another victim, another case of it just being so pervasive in this country for the past few years that really, well, who do you start the blame with, I guess, is the question.
What is the relationship with this lab in China now?
Well, it's pretty much all but fizzled out. And the reason for it is that CSIS has now been very active on research and university campuses across the country to warn potential scientists about getting involved with suspected Chinese agents and those who are working for what's called the Thousand Talents Program. So there's sort of two layers to this, right? You've got the Politburo in China that's encouraging the acquisition of foreign knowledge and intelligence through the United Front or the United Workers Front organization. They basically create programs like the Thousand Talents Program that will send over qualified researchers, professors, and scientists to go abroad with the understanding that they're there to basically further their own careers. But then along the way, some instructions will be sent over to either bring some materials back, or maybe even to bring some experts from a target country like Canada over to China and then further create influence in there. As much as we've seen some of the reports in Canada, our allies in the Five Eye Nations, the United States, New Zealand, and Australia in particular, they've been very much targeted by this program and by Chinese agents using this style. And it's prolific just how much knowledge has gone to the government of China at the expense of taxpayers in all of those countries.
As you mentioned, there was lots of evidence when this all, or lots of red flags to question and raise eyebrows here, yet there never seemed to be a lot of follow-up here. Where are we going with this? Are we trying to get to the bottom of this, whether it's this or election interference or what have you? It seems there's a cloak of secrecy here, whether it's top secret confidentiality, what have you, that we'll never get to the bottom of it. Will we get to the bottom of this?
I think it's more of a case of who is going to be in a position to take the next step, right? The documents that CSIS has actually revealed are actually pretty transparent and clear in terms of the knowledge and intelligence that they've collected. And not just with this case, but other cases that have popped up along the way. So, we're seeing that there's the ability to gather the intelligence. And the question then becomes, at what point do you act on it? And then who acts on it? Is it the RCMP? Is it a partner government somewhere else? Who's actually able to follow up and trying to make counter what's been done incorrectly here? And that's where I think the problem is. There really has been not a lot of political leadership in Ottawa to go after this issue to begin with. And then secondly, who's actually going to carry it out? It would by rights fall under the RCMP's jurisdiction to pursue any sort of criminal activity or anything that goes against any of the security acts that are here in Canada. But someone ultimately has to be the one to encourage that to go forward. And until then, we sort of see these cases sort of fade into distant memory. I mean, don't forget, this was also the time when Canada and China were actively pursuing a partnership for COVID-19 vaccine.
Yes, and absolutely. That was one of my next questions. What about the timeline here?
Oh, yeah, this absolutely falls into place. I mean, let's roll the clock back into 2020, and we see that some of our other allies, and I'm going to point directly to New Zealand on this, they at this point in early 2020, they had started to move away from what even the World Health Organization was putting forward as data about the COVID-19 pandemic. They're using their own military intelligence to do planning on this. Canada was not. Canada had access to the similar sort of documents, but we were still entrusting the WHO data through the government of China. And that was likely for two reasons. One, not to offend partnerships with China in early 2020. There were still quite a few trade deals from coast to coast that were dependent on Chinese trade. And the second was that there were plans put in place for a COVID vaccine that would be developed in Canada, tested in China, and then retested here in Canada, and it never came back. So it was a position of fear of breaking up international relations with China that sort of led to that that cooling process, maybe overlooking some of the depth of this interference along the way.
Dr. Robert Hewish with us, Associate Professor, Department of International Development Studies, Dalhousie University. Fascinating discussion about the Winnipeg Microbiology Lab, and will we ever get any more answers? Robert, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Always a pleasure. You guys take care now.
Well, the pressure to halt, pause, do anything in regard to the carbon tax, which is set to increase April 1st, has, I don't know if it's hit a tipping point or not, but the bucket is certainly filling up. Eight premiers questioning this, including the latest, Premier Fury from Newfoundland, saying to halt the tax increase. And as well, Ontario Premier Doug Ford saying the same thing in regard to the federal carbon tax, saying it would cost them. Annihilation was the word he used in the next federal election. Let's bring in Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data. He's here now. Tim, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Scott, nice to talk to you. Just back from Newfoundland and Labrador, in fact, for a March break with my son on what we like to describe as the Florida of the North Atlantic. Never mind the 85 centimeters of snow.
That's all in the details. Who cares? All right. It's about the spirit. So speaking of spirits, does any of this matter? I mean, we've heard these calls before. Is the pressure growing greater? Is the Prime Minister listening?
Well, I gather he had like an 8-minute answer this morning to the latest call from Premier Fury. To be fair to Premier Fury, it's not the first time he's done this in terms of saying pause on the carbon tax. He's said it before. But when you give an 8-minute answer and the answer's still no, I think that answers your question that, they're still trying to find a way to turn carbon pricing, carbon taxation, whatever you want to call it, into a winner for them. And it's just not happening. I mean, Premier Fury, so your listeners understand, has been a loyal supporter of the Prime Minister. He actually, when Justin Trudeau was running for the leadership of the Liberals 10 years ago, helped organize for him. So this is not somebody who's by nature a dissenter, and he's done well with the Trudeau government. But look, what's happening in Newfoundland and Labrador is happening elsewhere, right? If you live in a province that doesn't have a ton of alternative transportation options, and guess what? We don't have subways. We have one bus system in the main city of St. John's. You got to drive. And along with everything else, the other costs at the moment, it's just tough. Pierre Poilievre was in town on Tuesday night, so the premier was not blind to that. And the other little provincial secret for you is the premier is probably going to go to the polls sooner rather than later because he wants to get out ahead of Justin Trudeau going to the polls in the event that that may produce some negative consequences for him in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Will we see a compromise here? In my reasoning, what about the accelerator tax on alcohol that was set to go up with inflation at 4.7%? It's been cut to 2%. Will we see a half measure with this?
Well, I don't want to take that the wrong way. Are you saying Newfoundlanders and Labradorians will drink themselves into oblivion, Scott, in satisfaction that and not drive instead?
Nothing like that, but I will never miss a kitchen party.
Yeah, no. I think you're going to see what you usually do from the government. You'll see little token gestures like the hold or pause on the excise tax, or it only going up by 2%, which is still an increase, mind you. If Justin Trudeau was going to do a full throttled retreat on carbon pricing, you have to think he would have done it sooner. If he does it now, what's the political win for him, right? I'm sure is his calculation, because it'll look like he's capitulating to Pierre Poilievre, and Poilievre will have the power. So, I don't see him making a full throttle retreat. Maybe if he steps down in a few months, a new leader takes a different approach. But right now, I think he sees that as a legacy item for him that he's not stepping back from.
So, and you don't think if he was to, say, cut it in half or even eliminate it, I'm not sure cutting it in half would work because that would just probably tick everybody off. But you, if he did this, it wouldn't change the fortunes of the party in any way, do you think?
Not at this point, I don't think, because it looks like he's selling out on what he's at least maintained as a core value for him, right? I think that's the problem. Now, to be clear, what Premier Fury is saying, as opposed to some of the other premiers, is put a pause on the carbon tax.
Yeah.
So he's giving him some room, but I don't even see him doing that, in line with your example of the excise tax. That's not quite a full retreat, but it might be seen again as an inevitability, because the people who are still supporting Justin Trudeau will see it as a retreat, because they may believe that Poilievre is going to win, and if Trudeau freezes this now, there'll be no hope of holding the line should a government change occur.
We've heard the environment minister say if there's any more carve-outs that he will walk. How do you think he's reacting to this? And do you think he would make good on that if in fact it was cut in any way or paused or anything?
Yeah, well, I think he will. I mean, he's got to have a job after this, right? He's not an old guy. He's only in his early 50s. He's going to need to work afterwards. And I think he wants to go back to his environmental movement roots. He would like to go back with some achievements, as he deems them. So I think, yeah, he would walk away and style himself as some kind of, you know, messiah who never retreated and never relented, which may work for future employment prospects. But yeah, I think he'd keep his word on that front if there was a change.
You talked about this being a pillar, a piece of Justin Trudeau's platform. It's a legacy object for him. Initially, this was all done, the carbon tax, to reduce greenhouse gases. The parliamentary budget officer said it doesn't make any impact on that whatsoever, and many thinking this is just a revenue generator for the Liberal Party. Then how is the carbon tax a legacy? And especially if another government comes in and kills it.
Sorry, they're trying to frame this as their version of the GST and or...
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, right? And, you know, I in Hamilton, Sheila Copps, she stayed to her word. She resigned if the Liberals didn't remove it and then ran again. I think they think that it'll be a GST tool of the future, that it will prove useful in addressing carbon offsets and GHG reductions going forward. Again, that's been part of the government's problem, though, Scott. They think they're smarter than everybody else, even when data is telling a different story.
Tim Powers with us, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data, talking about pressure on Justin Trudeau to pause, do something with the carbon tax. Tim, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
I'm going to go use that excise benefit now, Scott, to have a beer. Thanks, buddy.
Bye. You do that. Fewer than half of Canadians believe the federal government's plan to regulate social media sites will make the platforms any safer. Polling firm Leger recently asked Canadians about the Liberal government's proposed Online Harms Act, which contains a suite of measures meant to make social media platforms safer, particular for children. Many say it is too vague. Half of the respondents said that they were wary of the government's ability to protect free speech, and a majority said they support the controversial proposal to introduce stiffer sentences for hate speech crimes. So, the intention's there, but are we convinced? And where do we go from here, moving this discussion forward and keeping everybody informed? Let's bring in Andrew Enns, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Leger, and here now. Andrew, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Hi, Scott. Doing very well. I hope likewise for you.
So far, so good. Where are Canadians with this? It sounds like they're a little confused.
Yeah, there's really, you know, this legislation just came out a week or so ago, and we went in and asked Canadians a few sort of general questions about the legislation. The topic itself is actually one that I think Canadians, we've done polling in the past, they certainly are aware and concerned about sort of some of the things you hear about online activity and propagating hate online and sharing personal images of people and some of the consequences. So this is an issue that Canadians are aware of. Looking at the government's actions here, so I think you touched on it. There's general, I would say, support with the intent here, with the effort. You had 68%, support the general thrust of the legislation, some of the specific measures around enforcement, there's even higher support. But where things get murky is, do they actually think it's going to make a difference? And, do they trust the government that this is going to, that they're going to do the right thing in this area? And that's where support starts to drop off under that 50%. And so I think you have this sentiment that Canadians want to believe something can and is being done to improve sort of safety and manage the online environment out there, but there's a lot of question whether or not ultimately this what the federal government has put forward is actually going to work.
It seems like there's that disconnect with a lot of issues. In other words, whether it's climate change, whether it's online hate, what have you. I mean, the concern is there. Where the disconnect comes is they don't agree in how perhaps the government's dealing with it moving forward. The issue's there, but it's the management of it they're concerned.
Well, you touched on it. I didn't necessarily look at it that way, but you're right, Scott. I mean, I think that's maybe a bit of the challenge for the government to some degree is that, they have to, and I'm sure with this one, they've got, 100% good intentions, but they really have to demonstrate that there is a clear formula that can help, because I think if this becomes, mired down or it gets sort of pulled apart and lots more questions get introduced in terms of the effectiveness, I think that becomes a problem for the government now in terms of people sort of go, well, here we go again. I mean, one of the aspects of the legislation is the creation of several new government agencies to help manage, this activity. And again, that on its own will start to raise some eyebrows in the general public in terms of like more government, another government agency. Yeah. Like, I'm not sure about that, right?
A bigger government when it's already exploded over the last little while. And when Canadians really want them, to perhaps tap the brakes on spending.
Well, yeah. And again, this is important. And so I think you'd get some latitude, but I think they really want to understand that this is going to work. And they probably for that, they're also going to want to see some evidence that this works in practice. And that's a hard, it's hard. I mean, this is sort of, I gather maybe somewhat new territory, but that said, I think that's the challenge for this going into this space, and it's probably why it took so long. I mean, I think the government talked about this several years ago, and it's probably to some degree why it took so long to sort of get going now. But we'll see. It'll be an active debate, and I'm sure it'll be active online.
I'm going to throw another wrench into this, Andrew. Obviously, today, U.S. announcing it's voted to ban TikTok if China doesn't sell its interest in the company. Do you think that will resonate in Canada? I mean, this reminds me of the big Huawei debate and 5G.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting because, certainly in Canada, we've got our own we've had sort of our own issues with Chinese authorities, with our electoral interference. We've got a commission underway now that's hearing evidence of that. I think there'll be some that will seize upon that decision in the U.S. to question what should we do here in Canada? Why wouldn't we do something in Canada? Are we exposing ourselves? If the Americans feel this is a problem, how do we feel it's not a problem? And I think that this could spill up into our neck of the woods.
Andrew Enns with us, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Léger. New poll, Canadians unsure of the online harms bill will make social media safer. Andrew, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Terrific. Thanks, Scott.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
All right, we know where we are with interest rates. And, of course, after historically low rates for, my goodness, it seemed like 20 years, post-pandemic, off they started to go, up, 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 and up. And we wondered when we were going to get some relief. Still are wondering that, but at least they have stabilized. Some chatting about when they are going to go down. And, of course, the other concern here, mortgages that are coming up for renewal in the time afterwards. So where is the sweet spot? And it's interesting because at least we're talking about them dropping again as opposed to going up. And we're having the discussion whether variable or short-term fixed mortgages are the way to go. Let's bring in Don Fox, Executive Financial Consultant, the Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management. And we host Planning Your Financial Future every Saturday morning. Don is here now. Thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Doing great, Scott. Yourself?
So far, so good, Don. So I guess the positive thing here is at least we're having this discussion now.
that's a great discussion to have rather than, are they going to keep going up? And yeah. And it seems, inflation has got under control. And that was the reason they put the rates up so much. So there was an influx of cash during the pandemic. And, economics would say that when you throw a lot of money into something, prices go up. And that would be inflation. But they didn't expect it to last so long. So then they started hiking up the interest rates and inflation got all the way up to 8%. So now you're seeing it hover to just under 3% in Canada, which is right in the sweet spot. They promised us that we would start seeing interest rates start to drop again. And they haven't quite got there yet, but I'm sure they're on the horizon.
So if you're in that window where, perhaps over the course of the summer, this is going to come due for you, what do you do? How do you gauge this?
Yeah, that's always tricky. And I think it really comes down to your situation and how much risk you want to take. Because if you go really short term, such as a variable rate, you're looking at prime less maybe a half, some are prime less 3/4. Well, the prime lending rate right now is 7.2%. Mm. So if you're getting even, 0.6 off, 0.7 off type of thing, you're at 6.5% interest rates. And versus if you go for a 4 or 3 year, you can get in the, 4.5% interest rate area. So you have to look at, okay, I understand that, how much risk do you want to take? If I go variable, then when interest rates drop, I can take advantage of them right away. But it depends how quickly they go down. And so if they go down slowly, you're better off just to go with, say, a 3 year. And upon the 3 year renewal, you'll hopefully be at a lot lower rate at that time. So there's lots of moving parts to it. How much can you afford? Your stage of life? Are you going to sell the house really quickly? How long will you sell? Are you in a divorce? Is it a new house? Or, so many factors. But if you're simply trying to time it, the rates would have to drop very quickly to make you want to say, okay, I want to go variable. And then it would definitely make sense.
So I guess the one common thing here, Don, is like we initially started the conversation with, I guess at this point, the environment has, there's little fear of them going up. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. I guess the only fear, there's some political risks with, Ukraine-Russia war, that can increase prices again, such as, oil, for example. There was those had actually popped up today with what went on over there. I guess that kind of risk is always prevalent. The other side of it is the U.S. It's probably the greatest risk, though, is they're almost having a bit of a party south of the border. Their economy is doing quite well, and their inflation rate is 3.1, not as low as ours, and it's a robust economy. So they're under no pressure to drop the rates. where we're in a different situation here. We're seeing a lot of bankruptcies. Our mortgages are coming due, and there's some foreclosures starting to pop their heads. So we're in a different situation. Our economy is barely positive. And so we definitely need to drop our rates to kind of spur things on. So the U.S. is a little concerned if they drop rates, inflation will go back up again. And we are saying we want to drop rates because our economy is not as good. So totally, you know, two different stories, depending which side of the border you're on.
There was concern a while ago, and I guess there still is now, that once these post-pandemic mortgages come due, that a lot of people are going to find themselves in difficult situations. That being said, we're hearing that rates are coming down over the horizon. Is this going to be as big an event as we think it is?
Huh? Could be. Okay. And I say that because when you see interest rates have gone up 4.75% since the lows, and they haven't dropped yet. So anybody that is seeing, we're starting to see a lot of mortgages come due. And if you were to get a 2% mortgage and now you're getting a 5% mortgage, well, that's a significant change in your monthly payment. And already I find there's a lot of people already tight because inflation was so high with, food costs and energy costs, et cetera. So it is tough depending on, how much wiggle room you gave yourself in the first place. If you were tight before, you could barely make the mortgage payment, this could be a very tough event. And so there has been, we're starting to see that now where people with money are actually looking to purchase houses that are under foreclosure again.
Right.
And we haven't seen that for a long time. So hopefully rates will drop quick enough so that they don't have to experience that.
Advice for those who are in the process of refinancing now or find their mortgage coming due?
It depends which pot you're in terms of what your lifestyle is, how much risk you want to take. I would go, if I were to take a ton of risk, I would say go variable because you can lock up any time and you'll get about 6.5% approximately. The safer route to go might be about a 3-year. And you're getting probably your best bang for your buck. And I would likely suggest that for most people out there to go with a 3-year, try to get the best rate. And when interest rates start to go down, I have a feeling you'll actually do better going in that route because I don't think interest rates are going to fall as quick as people had hoped.
All right. And as always, every shoe size is different. Don Fox with his executive financial consultant, the Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management. Make sure you're listening to Planning Your Financial Future with us every Saturday morning. Don, we'll chat on Saturday. Have a great day.
You bet. Thanks, Scott. You too.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We talked about this a lot because it just so happened that the day that PharmaCare was announced by Jagmeet Singh of the NDP, he was booked to come on the show. So we were very excited about that. He was certainly very excited to be making the announcement. He called it a historic announcement. And when I pressed questions for details, he really couldn't offer a lot. Like, what happens to the existing plan? Is this the right way to go? Because everybody thinks everybody should have the right to PharmaCare in whatever they need. It's just like anything, is this the most effective way to do that? And what I thought was fascinating was this was such a historic day for Jagmeet Singh. We didn't hear anything from the Prime Minister, and it wasn't until later the next week that he even really acknowledged this. So is there really a PharmaCare plan or just the promise to look at something? And is this really a priority for the Prime Minister? Let's bring in Muhammad Ali, Vice President, Crestview Strategies, and here now. Muhammad, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Hi, Chris, Scott. I'm doing well. How are you?
So far, so good. So we are shy on details here. Is this a PharmaCare plan or a promise to look at one involving the two categories of birth control and diabetes? Where are we with this?
So, great question. I think the government has been, and the NDP, when they have been negotiating this, it was a bit of, and why the delay happened is, how do we roll this out, the cost? Are we doing a fill the gap? Are we doing universal? Can we do the phased in? These are all sort of key sticking points throughout the negotiations. And so what we saw is really the first iteration, like the first stage of it, because the government wasn't going to be able to just roll out a massive program for two reasons. One, the price tag, they have been very clear. It's a lot for them to take on right now. Some have pegged it close to $40 billion or as low as $19 billion for a full program. So it's not chump change. The second thing is the provinces and territories. They administer healthcare, so there has to be a negotiation of like actually working with their programs so that the actual pharmacare, the drugs that people can get were actually going to be dispensed from the provinces. So, very similar to say like the child care agreement.
Sure.
It's all tied with the provinces. They announce it. And so that's sort of the two things that why we're seeing a bit of maybe a shorter version or a smaller version than perhaps what Jagmeet Singh was alluding to in his preemptive announcement.
You talked about filling the gap versus universal pharmacare. It seems like the majority of the provinces want to fill the gap as opposed to replacing the whole system with another bloated bureaucracy. I mean, we look what we're dealing with healthcare. Are we replicating the same problems with this? I've had the Ontario Pharmacy Association on. They've said they want a mixed version. So who really asked for this? And again, when the leader of the NDP comes on and says, well, they deserve this, and of course, everybody would agree with that. But is this the most effective way to do it? Because he's pushing a universal plan. He's not pushing a fill the gap plan.
Yeah. And this is a very much a friction point between both sides, because the government wanted to use a fill the gap model because from a cost perspective, and it made more sense, but also there is tons of private insurance out there that covers the majority of Canadians. So why duplicate that or displace that to just simply use taxpayer funds for that? So, that was the challenge they faced. So, and the NDP have always been about universal. Everything's universal for them. Doesn't matter who you are, what bracket or whatever you are, everyone just gets the equal access whatsoever. So it's, that is the tension point between both of how this is, described and carved out.
With the concern over the healthcare system and its universality and where we're going with this, does it make pharmacare more difficult to sell? Because at the end of the day, from what I'm hearing, there really isn't a pharmacare plan. There's let's fix the hole, fix the gap, but there's no nothing to suggest that we're anywhere heading towards a universal pharmacare plan.
I think there are signs that they're working towards that. Again, like this is sort of a first step. And the negotiations, why it went to where it was because like, how do we roll this out effectively? Right. The NDP really want is all rolled out right off the bat. Every hundreds of drugs covered right away. And that just wasn't feasible right off the bat. There were some that are able to sort of, hey, can we get a basic framework together on diabetes drugs and contraceptions. So that is a little bit more tangible for provincial governments to negotiate, because not every province actually allows for that or just provides that kind of support for contraceptions and diabetes. Some do, some don't. So there is a bit of the, a chicken and egg situation also with this program, where the government has to, obviously maintain his relationship with the NDP because it's a core component of their supply and confidence agreement. So they have fulfilled that and haven't fulfilled its passage. But also, they can't just, magically say, hey, like, look, we're just going to negotiate. There had to have been something that demonstrates what is some basic parameters. Now, the details aren't there, I think almost intentionally, because each province will have a unique set of negotiation and how that works out. What does the funding look like? Is this a straight transfer from the federal government to the provinces, like a childcare agreement or a healthcare transfer? Or is this more on a per usage basis? And so then that kind of gets billed back into a program that establishes for each individual province and territory. So that is where it probably is not going to be a lot of that detail in this legislation until it passes. And we'll see that after when some of the negotiations sort of come to fruition.
If every province is unique, then and will require a different situation, then how could it be universal? even in the end result. And if there's a slow rollout like this, won't that suggest eventually that the mixed way is, as such as the Ontario Pharmacy Association is suggesting, is the better way? Yeah, if anything, if anything, just for a timeline and getting it done.
Yeah, timeline's a big question. Can they get this done in time? You know, there's tons of other priorities for the federal government to deal with, the province, healthcare being in general one. You know, they're just finalizing all these action plans to actually get the actual health transfer funding out to get to the hospitals, doctors, and such. So I think this is sort of going to be tied in a little bit with that. Now, when do they get this done? Also, we have an election looking, you know, at October 2025, could be a little bit earlier. You know, the pressure will be on the government to try and get these deals done as quickly as possible. In addition, that once they have that, then they'll have to lay out what the next step is.
And let me ask this. Mohammed, and we got limited time here. Sorry about that. But I was talking to Nick Nanos from Nanos Research. He said that none of this has even moved the meters at all.
It's
nobody's really looking for this.
It hasn't. And I think, but the thing that comes back to is the NDP and the Liberals who agreed to work together to ensure the stability of Parliament. This is a core component. And for the NDP, this has been one of their unbreakable requirements that they have to pass, because they fundamentally believe that their members care about this, right?
Right.
And part of Liberals are like, look, if we're going to make this work, how do we sell this to our voters? So part of this is like a slow drag, allows them to take it to an election probably and say, look, guys, we've got this first batch in. We can do more if you give us reelected another mandate, because this is the framework we're looking to put together. So that's sort of the thinking that can probably go into this.
Mohammed Ali with us, Vice President with Crestview Strategies. PharmaCare, is it or isn't it? Mohammed, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you.
The headline reads, Putin says Russia is ready to use nuclear weapons if its sovereignty or independence is threatened. Here we go again. They have said this various times throughout the course of this, Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is gone 2 years by now, and was supposed to be over within a week. It was just an operation for Putin, but obviously the resistance a lot greater, and this conflict has just dragged out and dragged out and dragged out, and has seen damage on both sides of the conflict. And the threat of nuclear weapons, is it really about using nuclear weapons? Because if he was going to, wouldn't he have done so by now? Or is this more to do with domestic politics at home and an election which is coming up in Russia, which it looks like Putin is going to win because that's the way they play? So is this really about international politics and what is going on in the world, or is it really about shoring up the political support at home? Let's bring in Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor, Political Science, Carleton University, and here now. Elliot, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Oh, thank you, Scott. Nice to chat with you.
So we've talked about this many times, Elliot. Every so often, the threat of nuclear weapons from Russia, and what you've translated to us is usually it has something to do with the domestic situation at home, or perhaps Russia's not doing very well and needs some sort of threat. What is it this time? Why is this happening now?
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And before the invasion, basically, the nuclear threat has shaped this entire battle right from before it even started. Mr. Putin has very successfully used the nuclear threat to set the conditions and terms of what was about to be his invasion, and he thought occupation of Ukraine. Before it even started, he waved the nuclear flag. Then we're finding out now, Scott, that in October of 2022, remember this started in earlier that year in March, the Americans were so concerned that actually there would be a use of a tactical nuclear weapon that they really geared up in October of 2022. We're just finding this out. The news is coming out that the Russians thought they might lose Crimea, and that would be a fatal blow to them. They couldn't handle that at all. So they really ratcheted up the pressure. 50-50 possibility was the threat assessment by the U.S., who then went to China and India, among other things, and called on them to get a hold of their friend, Mr. Putin, and tell them to back off. And he did, apparently. Mm. He did not proceed. And the U.S. has said since then, even though we've been hearing all this comments, they never seem to change their threat posture to move this stuff into place. Therefore, we won't. So what's going on right now, you've asked? Well, the election is on. That may have something to do with it. The State of the Union that he just gave was even more bellicose than the statements we're talking about as of today that's in today's paper. But there's no doubt at all that he has laid down his red lines, that there's not going to be a threat. He won't use nukes unless there's a threat to territory or national integrity, which for me, for him, means anytime, Scott, because he's in Ukraine occupying things which he has incorporated into the officially into Russia. So it's very I don't take this sort of thing idly or lightly.
So what is that threat assessment now?
The threat assessment now is, well, he may not mean it. Again, they watch, the U.S. watches and others watch very, very carefully. Are they actually moving material around? But some of this material can actually be used, the tactical nuclear weapons, the so-called, meant for battlefield or citywide rather than countrywide destruction. Those can be moved more easily because they fit onto warheads. That can be either, you know, one kind of warhead or another. So there's real concern, I think, that if there is a threat he might lose, he might actually use tactical nuclear weapons, and everybody's keeping an eye on that. And that's not the only threat, by the way, that comes out of this in terms of nukes.
We've asked this a few times, too, to you. What are Russians, how are Russians viewing this? How are the Russian citizens interpreting this?
Well, they probably don't know anything much about it. This is really an appeal to the ethnic Russian population, the heartland of Russia, to rally around their leader who is protecting them against all comers and will use any means necessary to do it. It's a patriotic move in terms of what he's doing to appeal domestically. But of course, the literate population knows that he's really putting his own country at grave risk. You can't say that I'm targeting others without knowing that others have really updated their targeting maps for you, for Russia.
Elliot Tepper with us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. Putin rattling the nuclear weapon saber again. Elliot, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
Oh, thank you. Always glad to chat with you. All those subject matters, always so serious.
I know. One day we're going to talk about knitting, Elliot. We'll just talk about fun things. Take care.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
This is interesting. We've talked about this before, but the U.S. House has passed a bill that could lead TikTok to be banned in the United States if the Chinese Communist Party, China, does not sell its stake in this social media platform, causing a lot of chatter. Let's bring in Reggie Giacchini, Washington correspondent for Global News. He is with us now. Reggie, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Good afternoon.
So will this happen, Reggie? I mean, what are the conditions of them continuing in the United States?
Right. So what we saw today was a was actually rare in that we had a massive bipartisan group of lawmakers working together, 352 of them working together, only 65 opposing it, ultimately to try and get ByteDance to divest TikTok and have it owned by somebody that is not a Chinese national. And, you know, it's worth pointing out here, ByteDance is a private company, but there are fears that the government in Beijing could use pressure tactics to force ByteDance to open up its data and provide information to the Chinese government. And that's ultimately at the crux of this year, is that lawmakers feel that TikTok could be a national security threat solely because there is simply no way to figure out if, when, and how American users' data could find its way into the government's hands in China. Hasn't happened. We don't know it's happened, but that's the fear.
Is this any different, Reggie, than the debate about 5G and whether Huawei would be a part of it, which it seemed to drag on in Canada forever, but the U.S. were quite firm with it? I mean, is this any different in the sense that there any company that works in China falls under their umbrella?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, there are general concerns that the Chinese government, that infrastructure that comes out of China could potentially be problematic, could pose a security threat to the United States or to the United States' interests or its allies. But in general, what they're looking for here is a way to ensure that not only does data remain uncompromised, but at the same time that the information that potentially finds its way into algorithms across TikTok also doesn't, find itself becoming propaganda-based or find itself becoming, interference-based. And that's what some of the concern is here. Look, this is a broad bill. That's why there are so many Democrats and Republicans pushing back on this. They feel that it infringes on civil liberties or freedom of speech, and that they also don't want the U.S. government being able to say who can and cannot operate an organization. But at the end of the day, this is stuck. We don't know if it's going to pass through the House to get to the president's desk. There's still kind of a messy bit on that end.
What are the chances of that happening? And why are the Democrats concerned about that?
Well, so look, the Democratic Senate is not really committed to this right now. And it's partially because there are some different committees on the Senate that are trying to work out their own legislation to try and deal with TikTok. This is kind of, it's interesting in that a bill comes to the Senate. There's no companion bill for it. There are concerns and chatter about the threats to national security. But, it's unclear if this is going to find its way in the hands of the Senate or the president. And there could be a couple of reasons for that. Look, it's an election year. TikTok plays an incredible role in the, in the push of information. President Biden himself has a TikTok account. And to take that away from 170 million users could lead to blowback. So whether they're slow walking on this or whether they're actually trying to figure out a way to get this done, we don't know. The bigger question, Scott, if this were to happen, if it were to divest, who would buy it? Who would have that kind of capital to pick up TikTok and not find themselves in any kind of antitrust matter if the big boys pick it up?
Is the policy with government employees not to have this on their government devices now?
It is. It's similar to Canada. There's a push. There's kind of a rule in place that government devices can't have TikTok. This faced a bit of legal pushback in the state of Montana. Worth pointing out, Biden does have this for his campaign. The campaign says it's not a government device because this is not a government operation. This is a campaign operation. But at the end of the day, there's a push to make sure that it's not on government devices. And it's because there's a lack of trust going back and forth between China and America. And remember, too, Scott, it's not like China allows for American operations in its country. WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, these are all blocked in China. So for China to now come out and say that this is bullying, this is anti-competitive, it's kind of sounding on hollow ears.
I know there's a lot of blowback from those that love TikTok, but, you have to believe in this high-tech world that can Americans come up with something better that doesn't compromise their security?
I mean, America had MySpace, America had Friendster, America had Meta, America has X for whatever X can and can't do anymore. But ultimately, TikTok is huge, and there's no saying that TikTok is going to be the forever app. Something else could potentially eclipse TikTok, but for now, in a social world, it drives a part of the economy. There is money attached to this app, so there are concerns that getting rid of it could be problematic to the economy. Will somebody else pick it up and create something new? I mean, look, this is a big country and there's a lot of technology here. Somebody's always going to create something new.
What is China's reaction to this, Reggie? And can this spread to other projects, other industries?
Sure. I mean, look, China pushed back. Foreign Ministry pushed back hard and said that this is a bullying tactic from the United States, saying that the U.S. fears competition. But again, U.S. media, U.S. broadcast, U.S. Apps aren't allowed in China because what the U.S. sees as a threat to its national security, the information that's true that could make its way into China is also seen as a potential threat to its national security. So, I mean, look, could we run into other apps or projects being caught up in this? Sure, this bill allows for the president to designate any foreign-owned app as a potential threat to the U.S. That's why there's so much pushback on this right now, because it seems broad, it seems too narrow, it seems too ambiguous for certain lawmakers.
Reggie Giacchini with us, Washington correspondent for Global News. Make sure you're watching Global Tonight for more on all of this. Reggie, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you.
Fascinating that TikTok or China doesn't allow any of our stuff there, but we're supposed to allow it here. And when we question it, we're bullying. When are we going to wake up and smell whatever? Back in like February 25th, a cyber attack on city council or city hall, rather, paralyzing city council, city phone lines, services, various connectivity issues, and it literally has been an issue for them since this all went down. Well, now the city has shifted its response from responding to the ransomware attack that disrupted the services to a recovery, restoration, and rebuilding phase, according to the city. To talk more about all of this and what it all means moving forward, and I guess at the end of the day, what we have learned from all of this, let's bring in Marnie Klucke, city manager with the city of Hamilton, in here now. Marnie, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me. I am doing well. Thank you.
Have you had time to catch your breath yet, or anybody down there?
Well, we have been working around the clock, and everyone is very diligent. That's for sure.
So what can you tell us about this? I know there's certain things regarding the attack that you can't say. You're in a rebuilding phase. What can you tell us?
Well, let me start by thanking our residents and our partners for their ongoing patience and support during this time. People have been incredibly supportive, and I very much appreciate it. As you know, Hamilton has been under attack by cyber criminals, and that isn't right. And unfortunately, these cyber attacks are becoming quite common. But fortunately, the city has plans and systems in place to address emergency situations, and we've enacted them and have engaged a team of experts to deal with this. As you mentioned earlier, I'm happy to be able to report that we're shifting from simply emergency incident response to focusing on recovery, restoration, and rebuilding. And so that's been our primary focus as of late. It's getting services and systems up and running again. I'm very fortunate because city staff have really risen to the occasion. It's a tremendous amount of work, as you can imagine, to restore and rebuild, but folks are working very diligently to protect Hamiltonians.
What can you tell us, Marnie, regarding city workers, overtime pay, and making sure all that's right?
That's a very important item. And it's, I can tell you that staff are being paid now, and we are committed to making sure that overtime is paid as well. So we're working on the system. Right now, we've got a team dedicated to that. So we should have that overtime and standby pay issue resolved soon. Again, we've got incredible staff who have really risen to the occasion. And I can imagine it's incredibly frustrating to not have your full pay, including overtime. But people have generally been very supportive and recognize a team working hard to make sure that their colleagues get paid, as well as vendors in the community and others.
So would you have to move to sort of a manual system, Marnie, while this all is a temporary measure until this all gets back up and running?
Yes, in many circumstances, we have moved to a manual system. So overtime and such has to be logged manually and then entered into the system. And that has been the case with some other services as well. So we're seeking to bring our online systems up, and you can have confidence that we will do so as soon as it's secure and safe to do so. But it's one step at a time. And in the interim, we found alternative ways to make services happen and to ensure people get paid.
And what about leaks or loss of information, citizens concerned around their information?
Yes, I can absolutely understand why people have concerns about that. It's a very important aspect. And at this point, though, we don't have any evidence of personal information being accessed. If by chance we reached a stage where it looked like that was the case, we have a responsibility to disclose that, and we would straight away. But at this point, we don't have any evidence that points in the direction that information has been accessed or compromised in that way.
So what's left to do? And you say, and I understand this is very painstaking. It's literally like one layer at a time. But what is left to do?
Well, we have to look at all of our services and the online systems that support them and bring them up. So it is an iterative process, and it will be one step at a time. Unfortunately, it does take time to manage and recover from these situations. And as well, as we return to services in the way that people are accustomed to, we also have to rebuild and strengthen our systems. We need to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. So we're building in additional security measures as we move forward.
That was my next point, Marty. You said earlier that there were processes in place that if this happened and those kicked in, that being said, there was still an attack. So how do we prepare for this moving forward? What have we learned from this?
Mm-hmm. The city has cybersecurity measures in place, and we do update them regularly. And of course, there's no security measure which will make a network completely protected from these criminals. But we also know that we have to take steps to strengthen and become more resilient in this area. So we are analyzing that as we move along. In time, we will have analyzed the impacts and be able to share more information in terms of what that looks like. But first things first, right now we're dealing with the attack, doing our best to serve Hamiltonians and then make sure our systems are protected. And in due course, we'll come back with more information and make sure that we've strengthened our systems in the way we need to.
So at this point, are you concerned about a second attack or just trying to get things up and running at this point? Because we have heard, especially if ransomware is paid, that sometimes they get hit again.
Yes. So at this point, we've really taken time to contain and make sure that we're secure and then that we're bringing things online only when we're confident that it's safe and secure to do so. So we do feel like we're in a strong position in that way. I've described it earlier today. Like when you have an attack, the first thing you do is you lift that drawbridge to make sure that everyone inside is safe. And so we did that. And then we're only bringing systems and IT services back online when we know that we can do so safely.
Is there any way to elaborate, Marnie, on who's helping? Is this outside firms? Are they? Is this personnel within the city? And anything you can shed on that?
Happy to share information on that. So we have a team of experts, and that would include internal IT staff, and Cypher is our contracted service to help with the incident response and forensics. We continue to build the team as well wherever we need to strengthen systems. And then we have other teams working on other aspects. So we've got a lot of internal staff working on service and how we make sure that we continue to maintain service levels and bring service up online in manual ways if we need to. And then we have team working on things like payroll and finding mechanisms to get people paid appropriately and vendors paid promptly. So it's an all hands on deck sort of process, and people have different aspects they're looking at.
Many companies, organizations have issues where technology and it goes down. When did you realize, oh man, this is huge?
So the system went down originally on the morning of February 25th, which was a Sunday. And at first it was thought it was an IT outage related to a server. By about 9 o'clock, 9:15 on Sunday evening, we realized that it was more than that and that it was a cybersecurity incident. And so then we took all the measures to swiftly respond, contain, and begin to try to recover and restore.
Message to citizens here, Marnie.
I just want to reassure the community that we're taking every step possible, that we're committed to serving Hamiltonians and making sure that we're dealing with the attack and the cyber criminals. And once again, thank them for their continued patience. We've had incredible support, and I'm so thankful for that.
Marty Klucky with us, city manager with the city of Hamilton, giving us an update on the cyber attack the city has endured. Marty, thanks so much for the time. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thanks, Scott. Take care.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He's here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you are well.
I am very well. Beautiful out today. Just lovely.
Hence the baseball song that we played, I'm guessing. Yeah, it is an incredible day out there, that's for sure. All right. The Prime Minister is still getting a lot of chatter about carbon tax. I think there's 8 premiers now that say do something with it, including the latest Premier Fury out of Newfoundland, which is a Liberal premier there. The Prime Minister came back today and said something like, it's not my job to be popular. It's not my job. It's my job to do what the right thing is. Is he putting a little too much emphasis on how
how powerful Canada is and how much Canada can actually do to solve this problem, because it seems like he thinks he's a little bit more influential than what he is. Because, you know, banging us for, you know, to curb the 1.5% of greenhouse gases that we emit, it just seems that we're barking up the wrong tree here.
Well, look, this has been an ongoing thing with this. You know, this government clearly believes very, very strongly in the carbon tax. Now, a cynic might say they believe very, very strongly in the money from a carbon tax to help pay for some of the debt.
It's a revenue generator. That's what I've said. The parliamentary budget officer has said this does not make any impact on the environment whatsoever. It's a revenue generator.
So I would have, to that point, Scott, I would have more, trying to think of the right word here. I would be more okay. I don't like paying any more tax than we already do, and we already pay a ton. I would be more okay, and I think a lot of other people would too, if there was some kind of well-established proof that this was making a massive difference.
Yeah.
And to your point, we on the world stage emit little. The cost of what we are doing to bring that down even further, and I don't just mean the taxes we're paying, because I know they like to say, well, we're giving you this refund. Yeah, but every time you buy a banana, you've paid more in carbon tax because the farmers and the trucks and the planes and everything else that has brought it there. But not just that, the not creating pipelines that would help generate billions of dollars in taxes for this country to help with our expenses and other things. And the real part of this that I always find so amazing is that it's not like other countries around the world have stopped using oil because we don't provide it. Yeah. They've gone to places that produce dirtier oil. So in the attempt to be virtue signaling and really like all this green stuff. And look, it's not wrong to be green or to want to help the environment, but we're actually doing the opposite. We are financially disadvantaging ourselves and we are creating more pollution in the world. This doesn't seem like it's helping. And I think an awful lot of people have suddenly said, wait, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Why are we doing this way? Maybe someday as we move along, we get towards something like that. But today we're hurting ourselves.
And, you know, with the world lining up to buy our cleaner liquid natural gas, you know, we really have to ask ourselves, is any of this saving the planet? Is any of this making a difference? And as the parliamentary budget officer pointed out, no, it's not. So if you really want to save the planet, as opposed to generating more money for the Liberal Party, if you really want to save the planet, you work towards getting the world off of coal and giving them what they want. And that's cleaner Canadian liquid natural gas. Not interested in that is the Prime Minister.
Well,
And that, getting the world off coal would make a bigger impact than whatever Canada's doing in its little ways.
There is, let's be cynical here. Can we be cynical for a minute or two?
Yeah, go ahead.
It is always of interest to me that with the technology that we possess these days, I did an interview for my other job today by Zoom. Zoom is a remarkable tool. Same with Microsoft Offices or whatever you call it. And all these things where you can now be in one place and talk to people in another place. The Prime Minister flew a giant plane from Ottawa to Edmonton today to tell people about how we need to protect the environment and all the carbon stuff that is going on. And I mean, theoretically, could he not have had a Zoom meeting with the Premier of Alberta and said, I'm showing you, I'm demonstrating how we're making things better. I could have come and visited you, but let's save how many tons of fossil fuel. And then I will have a press conference here in Ottawa because, look, all the people who are going to interview him are in Ottawa anyway at the press gallery. We could have done all of this, and yet, no, we have to do the thing that apparently is really bad, but not, I guess, when it's politicians doing it. The logic of a lot of this stuff just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Canada sending thousands of people to the environment conference, whatever the heck it was called, in Scotland last year. We sent thousands or hundreds or whatever it was of people by plane. Really? Like, to save the environment, we're going to burn that much fossil fuel. It so rarely makes sense that when you then try to make the case that, oh, we have to tax you more, but don't look at what I was doing over here. Like, ignore that. But here's where we're going to tax you, and it's really going to help. I think people have seen through some of this and are saying, I don't see that we're making any difference.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Scott, as always, thanks for the time. Have a great show.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, for the last word. This one via email from Steve. I think it might be an oldie, but a goodie. Politicians need to be changed often, like a diaper, and for all the same reasons. As ever, Steve. Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.